compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning. Happy Taco Tuesday. Muchas enchiladas, everybody. Patrick Madrid here. My number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. You may have heard, if you were listening to John Morales and his team on Morning Air, mention of the Feast of Saints Peter and Paul. And you might wonder, well, why do they celebrate them together as opposed to, say, celebrating two separate feast days? Well, the reason for this feast day is that they have always been considered, you might say, the co-founders of the church in Rome, because both were in Rome. And Peter was in Rome quite a bit longer than St. Paul was. St. Paul did more travels, and he would come and go, but he spent quite a bit of time in Rome. And they were both martyred under the Emperor Nero during the persecution of the Christians that really flared up at when he scapegoated Christians as being the purported arsons, I guess is the right word, for burning down half the city of Rome. And so St. Paul was martyred by having his head cut off, and St. Peter was crucified upside down. I'd like to share with you some background on St. Peter's time in Rome. And how do we know that he went to Rome? I recall running into this argument from a Protestant source one time. I put it down in one of my books called Pope Fiction. And the argument was the Bishop of Rome cannot be the quote-unquote successor to Peter, since Peter was never in Rome. The Bible nowhere says he went there. And Paul, who did go there, never mentions Peter being in Rome. If Peter were the Pope, he certainly would have mentioned it. So that's the essence of a common argument against the Catholic teaching, that not only did Peter go to Rome, but he also died there. That's historically demonstrable. And what flows from that is that the successor of St. Peter, the Bishop of Rome, becomes the next Pope. So I'd like to share with you the details of the story. And it goes like this. I begin by sharing with you a story that I like. It's rather funny. A college student was in a philosophy class which had a discussion about God's existence. The professor presented the following logic. Has anyone in the class heard God? Nobody spoke. Has anyone in this class touched God? Again, nobody spoke. Has anyone in this class seen God? When for the third time nobody spoke, he simply stated, then there is no God. One student thought for a second and then asked for permission to reply. Curious to hear this bold student's response, the professor said, okay, and the student stood up and asked the following questions of his classmates. Has anyone in this class heard our professor's brain? Silence. Has anyone in this class touched our professor's brain? More silence. Has anyone in this class seen our professor's brain? And when nobody in the class dared to speak up, the student concluded, then according to our professor's own logic, it must be true that our professor has no brain. The fact that the Bible doesn't say that Peter went to Rome and died there doesn't mean that he didn't. Trying to prove that St. Peter did not go to Rome and die there is a lot like trying to prove that St. Mark didn't write the Gospel of Mark. That Gospel, like those of Matthew and Luke, was written anonymously, with no mention of the author's identity. But that shouldn't trouble us, because the external evidence, not to mention the internal linguistic evidence and the testimony of the early church, overwhelmingly corroborates the claim that Mark wrote the gospel attributed to him. Similarly, it's true, the Bible nowhere explicitly says that St. Peter went to Rome, but that shouldn't trouble us either, because the surrounding historical evidence is more than sufficient to prove that he did. Before we examine that evidence, let's first ask, if St. Peter didn't go to Rome, where did he go? Where did he die? We'd expect to find plenty of evidence in the writings of the early church telling us where this prominent apostle carried out his final years of ministry, if it were in some place other than Rome. The historical record contains no hint that he ended his days anywhere else but Rome. No other city except for Rome ever claimed to possess the site of his martyrdom or his tomb. And early Christians were extraordinarily diligent about making and proving such claims. No other city, not even Antioch, where he resided for a time during his apostolate, claimed that he ended his days there. No church father or council or any other church record indicates that Peter finished his days anywhere else but in Rome. That's the lack of evidence side of the coin. The flip side is the mountain of evidence proving that he did indeed go to Rome. Everyone everywhere in the early church agreed that St. Peter went to Rome, ministered there for over two decades, and, hang on a second here, and suffered martyrdom by inverted crucifixion in AD 65 under the persecution of the Emperor Nero. Given the grave danger to the early church from a hostile Roman government, it makes sense that St. Paul would not mention St. Peter's whereabouts in his letters. He didn't want to draw unfriendly attention. It's also possible that St. Peter had not yet arrived in Rome when St. Paul was writing. We even see St. Peter himself making what seems to be a cryptic reference to his own presence in Rome when he says in 1 Peter 5:13, "The chosen one at Babylon sends you greetings, as does Mark my son." Babylon was a commonly used code word for Rome among Christians because its pagan decadence in opposition to Christ was reminiscent of the idolatrous wickedness associated with ancient Babylon. But once St. Peter had been martyred, the testimonies of his sojourn in Rome with St. Paul poured forth in a flood from the early Christian writers. Perhaps the most detailed came from St. Irenaeus of Lyon. He died in the year 200, and in his apologetics work Against Heresies, he gave a detailed account of the succession of the bishops of Rome from St. Peter down to his own day. He referred to Rome as the city, quote, "where Peter and Paul proclaimed the gospel and founded the church." Other notable examples were St. Ignatius of Antioch, who died in the year 107. He referred to the church at Rome as the church of Peter and Paul in his letter to the Romans. St. Cyprian, who died in the year 251, he described Rome as the place of Peter. And St. Jerome, who died in the year 420, called Rome the see or the seat of Peter. Around AD 166, Bishop Dionysius of Corinth wrote to Pope Soter, saying, "You have also by your very admonition brought together the planting that was made by Peter and Paul at Rome." Besides the vast amount of historical evidence showing that St. Peter went to Rome, modern archaeology has clinched the case even more tightly by a definitive scientific demonstration that his bones, studies show that they are bones of a powerfully built elderly man who died of crucifixion, these bones are interred directly beneath the high altar in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, several levels down, where the original first century Vatican Hill sloped away toward the Tiber River. This was just outside the walls of what was once Nero's Circus. And if you've ever seen, let's say, the classic Ben-Hur movie starring Charlton Heston, and I think there's a modern remake of it, that's what we're talking about, an amphitheater style, but it was oblong. It wasn't round like the Colosseum. And they would race chariots and they would kill people and they would fight wild animals and gladiators and such. And that's what was there right where or just next to where St. Peter's Basilica stands right now. So this was just outside the walls of ancient Rome, and Christian records and even non-Christian records for that matter, they say that St. Peter was crucified and buried there. In his monumental book, The Bones of St. Peter, author John Evangelist Walsh presents a compelling archaeological case that conclusively demonstrates that the bones of St. Peter are indeed buried below the main altar in St. Peter's. He shows that during the first 2 centuries after his martyrdom by inverted crucifixion in the nearby Circus of Nero, Peter's modest grave was venerated and visited as a shrine by Christian pilgrims from across Europe and the Mediterranean world. During the persecution of the church by the Emperor Valerian in the 3rd century, St. Peter's bones were removed by Christians from the grave on Vatican Hill and moved for safekeeping across the Tiber to the catacombs of St. Sebastian along the Via Appia Antica. The remains of St. Paul were also brought there, and the bones of the two saints reposed undisturbed in the catacombs for the next 300 years. In the 6th century, the bones of St. Peter were brought back to Vatican Hill and interred beneath the main altar of the original Basilica of St. Peter's, built in the early 4th century by the Emperor Constantine to honor the apostle. The bones are still there in a stone ossuary about 30 feet below the high altar. This evidence is important because it corroborates the constant tradition of the church and the unanimous testimony of the early fathers, who say that St. Peter indeed went to Rome. He labored there for many years and then he died a martyr's death. So we have the evidence and we have the bones to prove that St. Peter was there. And you know, an interesting little detail about the bones, they were found by accident. So when the Emperor Constantine allowed Christianity, he allowed the Catholic Church to emerge from the catacombs, and he stopped all of the persecutions that had raged intermittently for the previous, 180, 200 years, roughly. He then allowed the Catholic Church to be legal, and he gave to the Pope, he gave the palace, one of the imperial palaces at the Lateran, which is now St. John Lateran Church, he gave this to the Pope to be a cathedral for the Diocese of Rome, for the city of Rome. And this all happened in the early 300s. So the church went rather quickly from being persecuted to being now made, you might say, the official religion of the empire. Now, that came with some pros and cons. It wasn't all hunky-dory because, for one thing, there were a lot of people who saw that they could curry favor with the emperor because he was leaning heavily in the direction of Christianity. So they thought, well, if we convert to Christianity, then maybe we can get some plum positions. And so there were a lot of people who became Christian, not because they believed in Jesus, but because they saw, you know, this is the way the wind blows, so they went in that direction. So without getting deep into that issue, we can say that the church experienced this very rapid transition from being persecuted to suddenly now being free to go about its business. And what's interesting about the bones is that the Emperor Constantine's mother, the Empress Helen, she came to Jerusalem and she wanted to find the relics of the crucifixion of Jesus. And she did. So she asked the locals, and eventually she was guided to a place where a cross and the nails and the spear and a crown of thorns and other artifacts were all together, and they had been reverenced by the Christians in that area as those belonging to Jesus and his crucifixion. So she was in the habit of building churches and monuments to honor the Lord, and the Emperor Constantine did the same thing by having a basilica built, the original St. Peter's Basilica, built over the top of where the bones of St. Peter were. Now, originally, when Nero's circus was in full swing, and the gladiator fights and the chariot races and all that other stuff going on, when somebody was put to death, it was not uncommon for them to be buried in a grave right nearby, and that's Vatican Hill. This is on the other side of the Tiber River from the famed Seven Hills of ancient Rome. The Vatican Hill is on the other side of the Tiber, so it's not part of those famous Seven Hills. And it was more or less a kind of wilderness. There wasn't much over there except for where the circus was, so people could go across the river. They'd have their bread in circuses, then they'd come back into the city. And those who were killed very often were buried in this sort of ramshackle graveyard to the right of where the circus was located. So at first, St. Peter would have been buried in a grave, but it didn't take long before the site of his grave was, it was embellished. And so, as often took place in graveyards, there would be walls that would be built around, almost in the form of like a room around where somebody's grave was, and then it would be open to the sky. And this was very common in Rome and other places in the ancient world, where they would become nearly like cities, where you'd have streets and alleys and doors entering into these areas, and the various graves would be inside these different places. And that's where the family could come and gather in relative privacy, and they could weep or talk or have a meal and visit the grave of a loved one. And this happened very early on with the bones of St. Peter. Eventually, there was built a what's called in Greek a troparion, which is similar to an altar, but higher off the ground than what would be typical at a Catholic church. It would be elevated on pillars, and there would be steps up to that level. And what was interesting about the troparion that was actually unearthed in this location is that it had a niche, a cutout, you might say. And archaeologists determined that, especially with regard to the Christians who were going to this place to venerate the bones of St. Peter, before the Emperor Constantine came into power, so this is when Christianity was still very much at risk because of the persecutions. Well, this was a handy way for if a priest or let's just say a priest was celebrating Mass on that troparion, on that altar above the bones of St. Peter, there would be a rider who could be out in that alleyway behind it with a bag, let's say, so that if the Roman authorities showed up unannounced and they were going to you know, get everybody in and capture them. Well, the host, the chalice, the other items that the priest would be using to celebrate Mass could be handed quickly through that hole to the man on the horse in the alley waiting so that those things could be saved and safeguarded. So as time went on, this troparion became more elaborate, and eventually, when we get to the time of the Emperor Constantine, so now we're in the 300s, he orders that this first basilica of St. Peter's be built. Now, if you've never seen this, you should see it. This is what was there for 1,000 years before the building of the current St. Peter's Basilica. The current St. Peter's Basilica that you see, or if you've been there, you've walked into it and you've seen it, it looks ancient, and it is, but it's only 500 years old. It's only about 500 years old, and it stands exactly on top of the place where that earlier, very, very big basilica built by the Emperor Constantine had stood for 1,000 years. Now, what's fascinating is if you get the chance and you go to Rome, try to take the Scavi tour. It's not easy to get because there are a lot of people who want to do it, and you can only go with a small number of people at one time. So maybe a dozen people might be able to go down. But the Scavi tour takes you below the main level of St. Peter's, below the lower level of St. Peter's where the popes are buried. It goes down much further, and then you go into this necropolis, which is, in essence, this city of the dead that I described a moment ago, where you have all of these graves of many of whom are these marvelous martyrs, the glorious martyrs and men and women and children even who gave their lives for Jesus in the amphitheater. They're buried there. And you can walk these streets, and all of it was unearthed, and eventually it was recovered and preserved. And it's just an astonishing thing to go down there and see. And you're several levels below the lowest level of the current St. Peter's. Well, what happened was, this was during the reign of Pope Pius XII. Yeah, I hope someday he's canonized the saint. There was a water leak in this subterranean area. And the San Petrini, or the workers who take care of St. Peter's, all the mechanical and, you know, all the stuff that needs to be done to keep everything in working order, they were working on trying to stop the flood. A pipe had burst. But what they discovered was the water that was coming from this pipe, it was sort of washing away dirt and earth. And eventually that's what led them to discover this whole ancient necropolis below the current St. Peter's. So they call in the archaeologists and the guys, the scientists who come in, and they unearth that. And that's how they were able to completely unearth this, and they discovered all of these things. And they discovered the grave of St. Peter. They discovered that troparion. And they wondered about it because there were many other graves that were put really close to this one stone box, an ossuary. And there was a lot of graffiti. You can see this box. I've been down there. I've seen it. The box itself had graffiti. And one of the graffiti, one particular graffito, says, "Peter lies here." In Greek, "Peter lies here," scratched into the stone. And what you can find to really cinch this case is the fact that not only do we have all of this historical pedigree and the documentation, these bones were located directly below the high altar of the original St. Peter's. They didn't know exactly where they were, but they had been told this is where it's located. And the high altar in the current St. Peter's is located directly above, you know, many feet above that. But if you were to go straight down below the high altar at St. Peter's, you'd get to where this box is, and that's where the bones of St. Peter repose. And then they did the scientific studies, and they discovered this is a man. He was an elderly man, powerfully built, and he died of crucifixion. So all of the essential details of the story of St. Peter, they all line up, and it gave us finally a kind of scientific certitude with regard to this custom, this tradition that the church had always had but didn't have that kind of evidence to support it, and now we do. So that's the story, in a nutshell, of the bones of St. Peter. We're going to take a quick time out. We'll come back, starting with your phone calls. The number is 888-914-9149. You can call right now. We've got a line or two open. Grab one. 888-914-9149. On this Taco Tuesday, I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
If you're looking for some exciting, interesting, unexpected conversation-type conversations, you've come to the right place. This is the Patrick Madrid Show. We're celebrating Taco Tuesday today as well. So have a taco on me. 888-914-9149. We'll go to Carlos in Napa, California. Hi, Carlos.
Hello. I'm wondering today, what are some simple arguments against the Protestant notion that the Eucharist is nothing more than simply a memorial?
Well, you can point out that the early church fathers write about it as a sacrifice. So the earliest Christians did not regard it merely as a memorial. It is a memorial, but it's much more than that, and you can bring to bear the writings of the early church to demonstrate that. That's probably, I would think, the most powerful way of doing this, because we could argue all day long about what does the passage of Scripture mean, and a Protestant doesn't have to budge off that. He can say, I think this is what it means. My opinion is as good as yours. Okay, well, I think it means something more than a memorial. So that can become a Mexican standoff if you just say, I think it means this. No, I think it means that. But how do you handle the fact that the early Christians who learned the faith from the apostles, at least in the first generation, how do you handle the fact that the early Christians, they themselves regarded the Mass as a sacrifice, something more than a memorial? That, I have found, pays a lot of dividends when you ask your Protestant friend to explain that. How do you explain the fact that they didn't hold your view, they held my view, the Catholic view, and the reason is because they were Catholic?
All right. Thank you. That's very helpful.
I'm happy to help. A good book I'd recommend, Carlos, is called The Hidden Manna by Father James T. O'Connor. It's a one-volume, what am I going to call it? It's not a textbook. I would say it's a one-volume overview of the Eucharist, both biblically and historically. And it even takes into account some of the developments that arose at the time of the Protestant Reformation in terms of aberrant views of the Eucharist. But I found that book very helpful. And I think you will too. Thank you. 888-914-9149. What do you make of this? The FBI tweeted out yesterday. This is the FBI. Tweeted out, today the FBI raised the pride flag at our headquarters in support of our LGBTQ colleagues. We thank them for their contributions to the FBI and the country. Hashtag Pride Month. And there was a picture of the FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. with a gay pride flag, LGBTQ, I'm not even sure what to call it anymore, the rainbow flag, flying proudly and flapping in the wind. What does that mean? What do you think that means? That there is now a gay pride flag flying above the FBI. What does that mean exactly? I think it's a symbol of being conquered. That's what I think. What do you think? 888-914-9149. What do you think, Cyrus? I mean, to me, this it's like they've been conquered now, and that flag is flying above it. What do you make of it?
I had not thought of it like that. Wow. Hey, see what you mean?
I mean, when you conquer an enemy and you capture their fort,
you put
or
up
their
your,
capital.
That's right. You put up your flag.
Yeah.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's flabbergasting. I mean, will the gay pride flag fly above the White House? It could. How about the Capitol building? It very well could. I mean, at the way things are going now, the hegemony that is being exerted by this movement and all of the, I think a lot of people are going along with it because they're scared of it. They're afraid that they're going to be crushed if they get in the way of this. And they have reason to feel that way because that's often what happens. So maybe if you're listening, I know there will always be that guy out there who's going to say, no, this is a good thing. because what it really means is just showing solidarity. Well, if that's the case, then how come we don't fly flags that celebrate other groups of people? Why don't we celebrate
really
all kinds
good
of
question?
Yeah, why this group?
Maybe we can.
That's
get
all
a,
I can tell you.
A Black Lives What's Matter that? Flag.
That may happen in due time. I mean, they're already painting the city streets, you know, blocks at a time with that slogan.
Wow.
So shit. It seems.
I had not thought of it in those kind of terms, and I'm speechless.
Yeah, it really is shocking. But it's not surprising, given the way things are going right now. So if the FBI has been conquered by this movement, what does that mean for the rest of the country? I mean, the military is being conquered right now. Did you see those sputtering general and the admiral on TV who were, you know, they're righteously indignant that anyone would question them because they're force-feeding racial indoctrination on all of the soldiers and sailors and airmen by forcing them to read books on white rage and white supremacy, things of that nature, the critical race theory. And they're the ones, you know, saying, you know, I just want to know about white rage. And I'm white, this one general said. He might have been the chief of staff. I'm not sure. So even our military now is being conquered by these ideologies. I'm sure the Chinese are gloating. I'm sure they're happy. I'm sure the Russians are happy. Can you imagine Vladimir Putin allowing this to happen to the Russian army? I don't think so. Can you imagine communist China letting this kind of thing happen to their armed forces? I don't think so. Because they're in it to win it. And they see, I mean, there's that old saying, Cyrus, you know, don't get involved if your enemy is doing everything necessary to destroy himself. You don't need to get involved. Just sit back and let it happen. And it seems like that's what's happening.
I have no words.
I mean, I'm laughing because I don't know whether to laugh or cry.
Yeah.
When you see that flag on top of the FBI, they've been conquered.
Hey, what happened?
Exactly. All right, Cyrus, I do have a serious question for you this morning, though.
Okay, serious question time.
This is a serious question. Have you ever had $50 billion in your checking account?
I think you can answer that one.
Yes?
No, I have never had $50 billion with a B?
With a B.
No, yeah. I have not.
Three commas worth. So not even once have you ever had $50 billion in your checking account?
That's a lot of commas.
Yeah.
Nope, not even once.
All right. Well, then meet Darren James, 47 years old. He's a Baton Rouge real estate agent. He lives in Louisiana, as you might imagine, because he's from Baton Rouge. And he came home earlier this month, and his wife held up the bank balance information on her phone and said, look at this. And he looked at it, and he saw that they had $50 billion in their checking account. Which was significantly more than they had in the account last time they checked.
My wife would be breaking this news to me from Mexico.
Like or Hawaii,
yeah,
right?
Or Hawaii, yeah, via you know, Zoom. Yeah. Look what was in my account.
Right. Yeah, suddenly she has her own checking account.
That's right.
So here's what happened. So he thought for a minute that it might have been a rich uncle who had left them some cash, which, if genuine, would have put them just above Nike co-founder Phil Knight and his family on the Forbes billionaires list. This story, by the way, from the New York Post, Lee Brown wrote it. He said, it was a great feeling while it was there to see that many zeros in your account. I'm part of the one comma club, not the three comma club, meaning that, you know, he had thousands of dollars, not billions. At least he had a one comma. You know, some people don't even have one comma.
That's right. I have a little bit of audio from this guy in the story.
Even better.
Yeah,
let's do it.
This is him describing.
He was a billionaire for 4 days with money he couldn't spend.
Yeah, taking screenshots every day just to prove to his friends. All right, this is great.
It was crazy to see what it looks like.
It sounds like a dream waking up a billionaire.
She says, look, and she pulled up our Chase account, and there was $50 billion. in our account.
Last week, this money was mistakenly deposited into Darren James's daughter's account.
She's like, no way. I'm like, don't get your hopes up. We can't do nothing with it.
After noticing the money, James called his bank.
I wasn't going to keep it no matter what.
Hoping to find out how it got there.
The thing that was most baffling was we wanted to know where it came from because we don't know anybody with that kind of money.
Although he didn't know how or why, the bank started reversing the error right away.
There was a hold on it and showed up Saturday. It stayed there Sunday, it stayed there Monday, and it was gone on Tuesday.
In a matter of days, their billionaire status was gone.
We took screenshots to at least be able to say, hey, look, we were once, I guess, theoretically, in theory, billionaires.
And if it ever comes a time this dream comes true, James says he'll leave his mark on this world by helping others.
There's enough greatness in this world that we can all have a life we never thought was possible. And so if I did have $50 billion, I would bless other people.
Now, if this happens to you, it's important to know that you cannot keep the money. Banks usually catch these errors and reverse the transactions. Banks can even file a police report, launching an investigation, and if anything is missing, you could face jail time.
But if you're a billionaire, wouldn't you go to one of those fancy, you know, prisons with,
probably,
with country clubs and people serving you drinks?
You could hire the best lawyers money could buy.
Oh, man.
Well, anyway, so that happened.
So you can't spend it or they'll come after you.
Yeah, I mean, because I think most people would assume that that was a clerical error.
Yeah.
Where let's say that you had, you know, a couple thousand in your checking account. You come back, there's $40 billion in your account. That's probably a clerical error. Yeah, I mean, if I had to guess.
A good chance. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like you might have forgotten. Oh, that's right. I forgot. I did deposit $40 billion in there. I just forgot about that. No, it's probably a clerical error.
Well, we'd never have to have another pledge drive if I found $40 billion
in my
account.
Can you imagine? And can you imagine that there are even people who don't like the fact that we might bring this topic up on the radio? Amazing. Amazing. But there it is. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Mike in Philadelphia. Good morning, Mike.
Oh, good morning, Patrick. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
Good. And shout out to Cyrus, too.
Of course. Cyrus has taken over little by little.
Hey, Patrick, you were asking what your listeners thought the pride flag flying over.
Yeah,
the
what
FBI
do you think of it?
Mm-hmm. And I guess, I mean, because it's a federal institution, you know, it's the people's institution. It almost seems to imply that if any represented group or underrepresented group, you know, has the ability to fly their flag above the FBI or any other agency, that, you know, shouldn't any other group, you know, the disabled, Native Americans,
the
maybe
Boy Scouts,
a flag for the unborn, maybe a flag for the blind, maybe a flag for, you know, name your interest group. Mm-hmm. It's a little unfortunate because I think the American flag flying over that agency represented all of us. And you know, now you start putting flags up there that only represent some of us. It seems a little bit disunified. But,
and a very small minority. I mean, numerically, and I don't know what the statistics are currently, Mike, but I know for the longest time it seemed, at least anecdotally, that 10% was the figure most people would say, you know, 10% of the population. I'm not sure it was even that high. Maybe it's higher now because it's being glamorized so much. But let's say it is 10%. Why? Well, I know why. I'm just asking rhetorically. I know why this is being done, because this is a way to force everybody into line. And in my view, it's a sign that the FBI has been conquered. And that's a sign that the federal government is being conquered. But yeah, your point is right. So why couldn't we have all sorts of other subgroups and subgroups have their flags flown at the FBI? And the reason is because this is the group that really matters. And this is the group that is truly being successful in its hegemony. It's conquering everything in its path.
Yeah, I guess my question, if I'm on the air, is... you know, I understand if Apple or Google or if the NFL wants to fly the flag, they're a private business, so they're welcome to fly anything they want. But my federal government, your federal government, you know, isn't there some sort of fairness at play? I mean, could there be a court case here if I come with a flag and say, hey, you flew their flag, can you fly this flag? And they refuse to do so. You know, is there a legal issue there because they are a federal agency?
Yeah, I think there might be. I don't know how those laws work myself, but maybe take into account the fact that you might be retaliated against. And I mean, look at, I'll give you an example, Mike. I just noticed this, I think it was last night. Tucker Carlson, who's a very popular host on Fox News, he released a video. Well, it was a segment from his show, but it was released on Twitter. I saw it again this morning, in which he says that the NSA, there's a whistleblower in the NSA that contacted his office, his team, and said, listen, I'm in the NSA, and he demonstrated that he was. And he says, I can tell you the NSA is spying on you personally. And he read back to Tucker Carlson on the phone excerpts from text messages and emails and things that Tucker Carlson says that only somebody who had access to those could possibly know. And they did a Freedom of Information Act request to find out what all information has been gathered. But Tucker Carlson has gone public with this very explosive accusation against the National Security Agency that it is spying directly on him for the reasons that they don't like some of the stories that he does. And they're planning to, according to him, they're planning to release this information as a way to embarrass him and get his show off the air. So when I saw that story, I thought, well, okay, maybe that's why some of these things are allowed to go without comment, because people are worried that if they speak up, that they might become a target from a federal agency or by a federal agency. I don't know how that figures into it, but that comes to my mind, Mike.
Yeah, I don't know. I maybe we should be inspired. You know, one of my emails today or the other day came in with a quote from Archbishop Fulton Sheen. Said something along the lines of, you know, if worshiping God becomes illegal, then let us all be criminals.
Yeah.
That's amen to that. Let's go.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be the first time in history where followers of Christ would have to stand against the government. So, you know,
I hope it doesn't come to that. Yeah, I hope it doesn't come to that, Mike, for all of our sakes. I want to live a quiet and peaceful life in all dignity and devotion, as it says in 1 Timothy 2. I'm not so sure some days, but we'll do the best we can, right, Mike? I'll be right back with more on this Taco Tuesday on the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Okay, welcome back. 888-914-9149. Okay, let's go back to Miami now. The site of that terrible collapse of the building. If you haven't seen the video of this, it's just astonishing. It's frightening. And I posted an infographic on my Twitter feed, at Patrick Madrid, if you want to see the different sections of this building and how they came down. Well, there's more information about this, in particular as it affects the Catholic families in the area. St. Joseph's Parish is very close to the site of this building that collapsed. Father Juan Sosa is the pastor there, and he says that 10 of the parish's registered families are in the rubble of that building. They remain missing and presumed dead. 10 families. So here's the information from the Miami Archdiocesan newspaper. It's possible, Father Sosa said, that the other families who lived in the Champlain Towers South and who worshipped at St. Joseph's Parish informally may be among the missing, since the area is known as a vacation spot full of short-term rentals and international visitors from South America and beyond. He said, plus, there are many who used to come on weekends from other parts of Miami who have worshipped with us, and so we are very touched by the idea of the whole community being bound together and praying together. He said this at a Friday morning news event just before celebrating morning mass, and that was for the intention of the missing family and friends there. He says, for us, it is very important to have something to do at this time to bring hope to these people. He's been pastor at St. Joseph's Parish for 11 years, and he was very familiar with the Champlain Towers. He said, I have visited the place many times, and I have been to dinner with some of those members who are missing. He says, when I first learned that the buildings had collapsed, it was horrendous because I didn't know exactly what part of the building many of those families lived in. But apparently, the 10 families were in that part of the building that collapsed. And some of those who are okay lived in the standing part of the building. He added that he hopes that some of the 12 families unaccounted for were away on vacation at the time of the collapse. Over the years, he said, he has encountered residents of Champlain Towers while out walking and exercising. The walking paths along the ocean behind Champlain Towers and other buildings in the area are highly used for morning and evening hikes. He said, it's like a community formed out of the need to exercise. And some of the people would stop and ask me for a blessing. Father Sosa visited the Family Reunification Center at the nearby Surfside Community Center twice on the day following the catastrophe, where he had an opportunity to counsel with some of the Catholic families there. He also opened his parish parking lot for the visiting search and rescue and volunteer teams who came to work on the site. From Kendall, St. Agatha's homeless ministry arrived at the parish Saturday morning with water and other supplies for search and rescue teams and their dogs. Wind, rain, and fires at the demolition site have hampered search and rescue efforts. As of Sunday afternoon, June 27th, the missing persons list stood at 156, with confirmed fatalities standing at 9. Some of the surviving families have told the media that this crisis won't be over for them until they receive word of their loved one's status. Father Sosa said, I am an optimist but sad about this horrible situation. It reminds me of September the 11th, 2001, but I want to keep hope alive that they will rescue more like they rescued that boy that we saw on television. His message to those affected by this crisis is to keep up their hope and keep your hearts on the one who can grant us the opportunity to see our loved ones, and that is God. Keep your hearts open so you will be able to feel and experience in the midst of grief the healing presence of the Lord. And I'll conclude by another quote from Father Sosa. He says, may we continue to walk together to help the needy and support our rescue teams and researchers, and searchers, as well as the many at the Surfside Center and other places who are relating to each other in ways they didn't relate before. Now, somehow, we are all together trying to alleviate the situation and pain caused by this. I know you've been praying for the people involved, and I just encourage you to keep praying for everybody involved, including for the souls of those who died in this terrible collapse. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Tammy, listening in Visalia, California. Hi, Tammy. Welcome.
Thank you so much, and thank you for taking my question.
You're welcome.
I wanted to know which book you would recommend or books for a young father who his children, well, his oldest child is now 12, and it's a young man. Okay. And the young father has to make some difficult, strong decisions in the next year or so, and he has to do it with wisdom at the same time. And I wonder if there are any books. This young mother does not have a large, older male support group. He unfortunately is not attending a parish right now.
When you say he has to make difficult decisions, do you mean something about his children or just like where to go to work or what?
Yes.
Do you mean?
Oh, no. Regarding his son. And it's going to take strength, but it's also going to take wisdom.
Okay. Well, a book that comes to my mind immediately is called Legacy, A Father's Handbook for Raising Godly Children. That's by Steve Wood. Now, that's not the only book on Christian fatherhood that Steve Wood has written. So my thinking would be to go to his website, which is dads.org, and look through the book section there. That's one that I'm very familiar with, and I think it would be good. Another book that Steve wrote is called Christian Fatherhood, and there's a new edition of that, and that covers even more topics. But my sense is that if he needs something to guide him as a father, the way St. Joseph was a good father to his foster son Jesus, that would be a good place to start.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And thank you for your show.
Thank you, Tammy. I appreciate that. And I hope that this young dad gets all the wisdom and all the strength that he needs to do whatever it is he needs to do. And by the way, that's a good book recommendation for any father or any soon-to-be father. You know, it's never too late to start bulking up on your knowledge and preparation for fatherhood. How about Daniel now in Sacramento? Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning, Patrick. Would you want to comment on the rainbow flag? You know, I was with my family yesterday over at the Six Flags here in California, and they had like a Pride Month, and they had an apparel with all kinds of, you know, shirts and flags and all of that stuff. I didn't know that, so I was there with my family, and I agree, you know, now it's conquering even good families, you know. I go to church every Sunday with my girls. They even sing in the choir, and they just see it so normal, you know. And I told them, you know, June is the Sacred Heart month. That's what the church teaches, and they just stay quiet. You know, there's like they being so brainwashed that it's sad. It's sad that even good families are being conquered by it.
That's what's happening. And I'll give you, let me juxtapose something to that, Daniel. There's a Kentucky police officer who was placed on leave because, not because he was flying a rainbow flag, but because he was praying in front of an abortion clinic. In the early hours of Saturday, February 20th, the Louisville Metro Police Department officer, whose name has not yet been made public, he drove to EMW Women's Surgical Center and joined his father in praying the rosary outside the clinic. The clinic was not performing abortions that day. A picture of the officer showing him carrying his firearm near an LMPD cruiser was posted on Twitter by a volunteer escort at the clinic. He was off duty, but he was wearing his uniform with a coat over it. In March, the abortion clinic released surveillance footage showing the officer pulling up in his cruiser just before 6 a.m., getting out and putting on a jacket and remaining with another person outside the clinic for about 45 minutes, at one point holding a sign reading, "Pray to End Abortion." Shortly after he started his regular patrol duty that morning, the officer was ordered to return to his division's office and was placed on administrative leave with pay, meaning that he was prohibited from making arrests, working cases, or working overtime hours during the months he was on administrative leave. He lost a substantial amount of pay, which he relies upon to support his wife and his four young children. So to your point, Daniel, you go to the amusement park with your wife and children to have a good time, and this ideology is being rammed down yours and everybody else's throats. And a police officer who's not on duty, and he's getting ready to report for duty, but he's not on duty, and he wants to go pray in front of an abortion clinic, which is perfectly legal, he gets put on leave and loses a lot of money because of the pay that he missed out on. So that's how things go nowadays. If you want to pray, now obviously they'll say, but he was in uniform, but he was, all those things notwithstanding, that kind of thing will get you penalized very quickly. And yet this ideology that represents a small minority of this population in this country, that is now able to pervade every facet of American life with impunity. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Yes. And at that time, a thought came to my mind, you know, like, what if we put up a billboard with the Sacred Heart, you know, and saying June is the Sacred Heart month, not a gay pride month. We probably go to jail. They probably wouldn't even put it on, you know.
Well, so they'd say, keep your faith to yourself, you know, keep your dogma to yourself. That's probably what you would hear.
Yeah, yes. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you. Appreciate it. I mean, there's not much more I can say on that topic. It's just, it's the way it is. But thank God for Relevant Radio. I must say that, because this is an opportunity for us to voice a different perspective on these issues. And at least ostensibly, we have the right to free speech, don't we? We don't really have the right to free speech much anymore. They'll silence you if they possibly can. So I'm grateful to God that we have the opportunity on Relevant Radio to speak about these topics in a calm and open way where everybody's opinions are valued and nobody gets silenced. And we can find out how these arguments shake out. You know, who has the best ideas? And my idea is, why are we letting this particular ideology conquer everything in its path? You know, the reason why I think it's happening is because people were too afraid or too lazy to speak up about it 30, 40 years ago. And they just didn't bother with it. And look at it now. It's a juggernaut. So anyway, we keep doing what the early Christians did. They had all kinds of things that were obstacles for them, but they spoke the truth in love and they kept going and they stayed close to Jesus. And glory to God. That's all I can say. There's no coincidence that you and I are born and are alive at this time in human history. And we're alive here for a reason. God wants us to play a certain role. So let's ask for that wisdom and humility and love and compassion so that we can speak the truth in love without fear. Perfect love casts out all fear, right? I'll be right back with hour two right after this.
Great Scott, Patrick! You're right!
Now!